This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Russia said on Wednesday it was fighting intense battles against Ukrainian forces that had penetrated its southern border near a major natural gas transmission hub. The acting governor of Kursk region said he had introduced a state of emergency. Russia has advanced this year after the failure of Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive to achieve major gains. Ukraine struck back on Tuesday in one of the largest incursions into Russian territory since the war began, and battles continue through the night into Wednesday. Thousands of anti-racism protesters gathered in London on Wednesday to challenge expected far-right groups that failed to materialize following more than a week of violent racist attacks targeting Muslims and migrants.
Say it loud! Say it good!
Britain has been swept by a series of riots that erupted early last week after three young girls were killed in a knife attack in Southport, located in northwest England, triggering a wave of false messaging online that wrongly identified the suspected killer as an Islamist migrant. Post online has said far-right anti-Muslim protesters would target a list of immigration centers, migrant support centers, and specialist law firms on Wednesday, prompting many businesses to close early and some shops to board up windows. Venezuela's legal system mounted more challenges against the country's political opposition on Wednesday. The head of Venezuela's Supreme Court ruled Edmundo Gonzalez, who challenged President Nicolas Maduro in the July 28th election, was in contempt of court after refusing to answer a summons to attend what it said was a certification of the results. The opposition said Gonzalez defeated Maduro in the vote. The 74-year-old former diplomat could face up to 30 days in jail for contempt. This is VOA News. Illegal practices in Mexico's avocado heartland, which is expanding rapidly to feed growing demand in the United States, comes at the expense of nearby forests. That's according to government officials. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner explains.
Local government officials say growing demand for avocados in the United States has led to deforestation as avocado producers use bulldozers to dig out illegal water reservoirs for their thirsty crop. Mexican law requires an environmental impact study and permit to store and use water for resource-intensive avocado farming. But in the town of Madero, only 42 reservoirs and wells had permits, according to data from the National Water Authority, CONAGUA. And activists say hundreds of similar water pools in the area have not been approved.
That was Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. The U.S. space agency NASA says chances are growing that two astronauts who flew the new Boeing Starliner capsule to the International Space Station in June may have to switch to a SpaceX capsule for a ride home. As AP correspondent Ed Donahue explains, the change could mean the crew could remain aboard the ISS until next year.
Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams were supposed to make a quick trip to the space station in June. NASA says there's lingering uncertainty over the safety of Boeing's new Starliner capsule. There have been problems with thrusters. One option being considered is for the Starliner to be cut loose to return to Earth empty. SpaceX is planning a taxi flight to the space station late next month. Seats could be made available for Wilmore and Williams on the ride back in February. That could mean an 8-month stay. Boeing issued a brief statement repeating its position. The capsule could still safely bring the astronauts home. NASA hired Boeing and SpaceX to ferry astronauts to and from the space station after space shuttles were retired in 2011. I'm Ed Donahue.
The women's 10-kilometer marathon swimming event in the Paris Olympics will go ahead as scheduled on Thursday in the Seine River after officials said water quality tests met safety thresholds. Organizers for both the Paris Games and officials with World Aquatics, the sport's governing body, announced the move in a joint statement. France has spent $1.5 billion on upgrading the capital city's sewage systems, promising the river will be clean for residents to swim in by next summer. But water quality issues proved a headache for organizers during the triathlon events, with practice sessions for both men and women canceled and the men's race postponed by 24 hours. International Edition delivers insight into world news through eyewitnesses, correspondent reports, and analysis from experts and newsmakers. We also keep you in touch with social media, science, and entertainment trends. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 8th, and here are some of the stories we are following. Kenya braces for today, Thursday, so-called 99 March.
August 8th has always been the day of the election for the country after every 5 years. So they are dubbing it Nane Nane. Nane Nane is a Swahili word meaning 8-8, the 8th of August. Kind of trying to say that it's a historic day.
Malnutrition surges in Nigeria's Bauchi state. Today is a day of mourning for those killed during the End Bad Governance protest in Nigeria. The UN Security Council says it will support the SADC mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
When the UN Security Council decides to support a mission in DR Congo, it simply means now it has elevated or seen the gravity of the situation in DRC Congo and feels that the UN should step in.
And our vice presidential pick, game changer for the U.S. elections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya is bracing for today, Thursday, so-called 99 March, to shut down the country, even though President William Ruto has called on Kenyans to reject the demonstrations, which he says could plunge Kenya into chaos. The proposed 99 March is part of a series of protests for good governance and accountability. The protesters have also called for the resignation of President Ruto. Kenyan police say criminals are planning to infiltrate the march and commit further crimes. The police said in a statement that they have deployed adequate security personnel. Mwangi Maina is a Kenyan journalist with the Kenyan Foreign Policy online publication. He tells me that August 8th is a historical day in Kenya.
The protest is still going to happen. I think his appeal or his warning won't stop people because it's a constitutional right for people to picket and to protest. And then the people have entirely or totally lost hope in his government. Surprisingly, what is happening is that the country is very quiet, including in terms of the kind of messaging or protest agenda you see online. Not so many people are speaking about it, and I think it's a bit shocking because you also do not know what people are thinking compared to how the protest started. And you could see people engage online because of the rage they had, but the country as of now is very quiet.
On the eve of the protest, the president has spoken to say that Kenyans should not protest, but yet you are saying also it's very quiet where you are. How do you interpret that? Could it mean that the quiet before the storm, or that Kenyans are listening to the president?
Well, I think, and from where I sit, I would prefer someone who is speaking, because when there is a lot of quietness, you do not know if a storm is brewing and it's going to come and blow you up. So I'm entirely thinking that the kind of quietness you are seeing is because people are so much rage and enraged. So they are seeing no need of speaking out, and probably tomorrow we're going to see. I'm trying to interpret two scenarios, that it's either the energy has gone down and the people are now tired of protesting and they are waiting for the 3 years to end so that they can head up to the polls and decide probably to deal with the government brutally at the voting center. The second scenario is that they have decided not now to speak, because they also want to confuse the government, not to be able to know the kind of agenda they are planning. And tomorrow, putting in mind that it's quite a crucial day for the country, because August 8th has always been the day of the election for the country after every 5 years. So they are dubbing it Nane Nane. Nane Nane is a Swahili word meaning 8-8, the 8th of August, kind of trying to say that it's a historic day. And of course, the kind of messaging I have seen online from the people who have been speaking out loudly is that they have, largely been borrowing with what has recently happened in Bangladesh. Because I've seen young people saying, we started the protests in Kenya, we inspired the people in Dhaka in Bangladesh to come out and start agitating for what they think or for what they feel is rightfully theirs.
Where you are in Nairobi, do you see any sign of security deployment?
No, I haven't seen any kind of security deployment, but from the area I am in, but so many other areas, and especially the areas that the government feels or thinks that it will be very easy for young people to be mobilized from, they have been able to deploy some heavy security to those areas. And of course, the central business district in Nairobi has started to be cordoned off in anticipation of tomorrow's protest.
Mwangi Maina is a Kenya journalist with the Kenya Foreign Policy Online publication. He was speaking with us from the capital, Nairobi, in Nigeria. Today is the day of mourning for those killed during the End Bad Governance protest around the country. Nigerians are asked to wear black to honor the dead. This comes as President Bola Tinubu appealed to Nigerians for the second day this week to abandon protests and gave his administration's reform policies time to work. Peluola Adewale is the National Mobilization Officer of what he calls the Joint Action Force. He tells me that the 10 days of rage will continue until this Saturday, and thereafter, the organizers will decide what happens next.
In Lagos, we have put down the protest. We've now declared the 3 days of mourning. Then we plan to have just a symbolic action tomorrow, asking our members to put on symbol of mourning of those that we killed. And on Friday, we plan to have a symposium and a candlelight procession to mourn those that we killed in the course of the protest.
President Bola Tinubu has again, for the second day in a week, has appealed to the protesters, you, the protesters, to have patience, to bear with him, his administration, so that the country will go through the troubles that it's going through now successfully. So don't you want to give the president a chance?
We declare the 10 days of protest. And the protest will be ended formally on Saturday. But we are prepared for a protracted struggle. But that does not mean that we don't see it every day of the year. But this truly be seen as a face of this 10 days of rage is face in the struggle. The organizers are definitely going to decide when we are going to return it to the street. The fact is that this is not the first time, and Nigeria has witnessed similar policies, similar appeal from the past government that became to be approved. The situation in Nigeria has been progressively declined, and it appears that new government is worse than the previous one. That is not likely for any improvement in the living standards, in the life of the vast majority of Nigerians. The idea of this protest is for the government to reverse its anti-poor, anti-people's policies, which are responsible for the attack on the living standards of the vast majority. But at the same time, the idea of this protest is that for the first time, Nigerians rose to register their objection to the policies of the government. And the government has been able to have it a few days because there have not been a protest of this case before now. Nigerians have made a bold statement that they are not prepared to accommodate the policies which Tinubu administration has been unleashing like a terror on Nigerians since its inception May 29, 2003.
But the president is confident that the policies he put in place following the removal of subsidy will work eventually if you, the protesters, can give him the chance or give the policies the chance to work.
The policy cannot work because it's about the basic means of livelihood of Nigerians. This is a country where there's no adequate or functional grid electricity or adequate transport system or mass transport systems. It means that for the basic needs, for the basic business, the people rely on the use of petrol, and for basic transportation, people rely on the petrol. And of course, if you light your home, you rely on petrol because of the failure of the government to provide the grid electricity. Because of that, once you remove subsidy from petrol, it has a multiplier effect on the income and on the means of livelihood of vast majority.
Peliola Adewale is the National Mobilization Officer of what he calls the Joint Action Front. He was speaking with us from Lagos, Nigeria. An unprecedented surge in malnutrition in Nigeria's Bauchi State has attracted the concern of aid group Doctors Without Borders. In a statement, the organization says it is scaling up inpatient care and working with the local community to treat cases of malnutrition earlier to prevent more severe cases and deaths. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, says it recorded an alarming 23,000 cases of severe malnutrition in Nigeria's Bauchi State between January and June this year, a 120% increase over the same period a year before. The group on Tuesday also said overall malnutrition in the West African nation increased by 40% nationwide and warned that without immediate intervention, the situation could become catastrophic. Fury Boyam, MSF's medical coordinator, says poverty is a key driver of malnutrition, but not the only reason why the numbers are surging.
From the feedback we got, so a lot of them were complaining that there is a significant increase in the basic food items. So the cost has increased compared to last year. So they can't afford 3 meals per day, a lack of access to health care and water. But also we observe like a poor infant and young child feeding practices among the breastfeeding mothers. The vaccination coverage in Bauchi is a bit low, leading to the diseases such as measles.
MSF has been responding to malnutrition crisis in Bauchi since 2022. The group said its treatment centers and personnel are overstretched and that they're trying to make room for more sick children. Nigeria has the second highest burden of growth-stunted children in the world, according to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. UNICEF says malnutrition is the direct or underlying cause of 45% of all deaths in the country under the age of 5. For years, Nigeria has been embroiled in a protracted war with armed gangs who often kidnap farmers and hold them for ransom. The resulting loss of food production, along with general insecurity and rise in food prices, have hampered the ability of vulnerable people to buy food. The situation is especially bad around July and August each year, the so-called peak of the lean season, when food from previous harvests normally runs out. Abubakar Saleh, Bauchi State Nutrition Officer, says authorities are working to bring the number of malnourished children down.
We are trying to scale up micronutrient supplementation for pregnant mothers. That is to start preventing malnutrition from the mother, for them to have a healthy pregnancy. And also in the area of treatment, we have one intervention supported by USAID, Ukraine, for the management of severe acute malnutrition. We are doing that. And also we are doing Maternal Health Week. It's a campaign. So through that campaign, we screen children for malnutrition.
Last month, MSF launched a community-based intervention known as Integrated Community Case Management in 8 villages and equipped local women with early testing tools to help them detect malnutrition faster. Boyam says it is bridging the gap.
They were trained to be able to identify malnutrition, sign of severity or medical complication. But also they were trained to manage on the spot the cases of simple malnutrition. On top of that, they are also trained to manage malaria.
But until insecurity is addressed and there's more funding to help the vulnerable, many more children will be struggling to survive. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 8th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The United Nations Security Council says it will support the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The council adopted a resolution Tuesday authorizing the UN Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic, also known as MONUSCO, to provide operational and logistical support to the SADC mission in the country. Edgar Gitua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He tells VOA's Douglas Umpuga that the U.N. support is critical to stabilizing the DRC.
So when the UN Security Council decides to support a mission in DR Congo, it simply means now it has elevated or seen the gravity of the situation in DRC Congo and feels that the UN should step in. So when they agree to support the SADC mission, it's because now the UN's mandate of allowing regional organizations to solve regional problems. So now the DR Congo being a member of SADC, the UN is simply just supporting and saying we agree with what the SADC region is doing in terms of peace and security on the African continent. But more so importantly, the support of the UN mission in DRC Congo also enables open logistical support, financial support for the mission to stay there longer. So the repercussions are what would have been probably a short mission now means once the UN starts pumping in money, the SADC forces are going to be in the eastern part of DRC Congo for a long, long time, which has its own advantages and disadvantages. Advantages in, of course, deterring the rebels, but the disadvantage comes from the fact that a prolonged mission, sometimes the mission loses focus, or the peacekeepers, the soldiers, start being caught up in a lot of side things. For example, the last MONUSCO was there, they were accused of many human rights violations. So the danger of a prolonged mission is that those soldiers are bound now to get caught up in local issues, and sometimes the mission loses focus. But the advantage, when the UN steps in, it means there is logistical support. They can now get better equipment and they can get better help to try and quell the conflict on the eastern side of DRC.
It's reported that Rwanda's President Paul Kagame was opposed to this Security Council resolution on the basis that it would collapse the Great Lakes region into a war involving 8 countries.
To say the objection of Paul Kagame is on a purely selfish basis. His objection is that the UN has said, they've been documented, that there are around 3,000 to 4,000 Rwandese forces embedded in M23 and in some other militias in eastern DRC Congo. Now Paul Kagame knows once the UN steps in, there'll be bigger logistical support. The mission will even be extended. Other countries could contribute troops, meaning the Rwandese troops are going to face a bigger enemy than they can handle. So Paul Kagame's agenda on the eastern side of DRC, supporting people who are of the same identity as ethnic Tutsis, he's not going to pursue that agenda in the eastern DRC Congo. Then the other issue around Rwanda is that there have been rumors that Rwandese troops in the eastern part of DRC Congo also involve themselves in illegal mining and all these things. So he is definitely not happy because the UN's involvement means Rwanda will have a tough time in advancing its agenda in the eastern part of DRC. So he is not happy. He knows his wings have been clipped, and he knows that his influence in that region is going to be diminished. His agenda for the eastern part of DRC will be diminished. And I do not see it degenerating into an 8-country conflict. I do not think. Everybody will welcome UN support for peace and security on the eastern side of DRC.
How do you see this mission working in the short term? Would it help the situation?
Yes. In the short term, definitely it is going to work, because part of the mandate for the UN, the moment those peacekeepers, it supports the mission changes its agenda, because now they also want a peace agreement to be quickly drafted between the DRC government and all these militia groups. In essence, when the UN steps in, it is giving DRC a chance to solve their own internal problems. And how those problems will be solved is through a peace agreement where they all say what they want. They craft an agreement between those rebels and the President Tshisekedi. So they will now exclude all other players. It now becomes a DRC problem because the UN has stepped inside. In the short term, I see them working towards a peace agreement, cessation of ceasefire, cessation of hostilities agreement, and hopefully now they start ironing out any other grievances.
Edgar Gitua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi. Rwanda has always denied that it supports the M23 rebels. Now that both the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates have selected their running mates, the question is whether those picks will actually help boost the campaign's chances of winning the November election. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at the historical relevance of vice presidential candidates and what Tim Watts and J.D. Vance bring to their respective tickets.
With great confidence in her decision, Vice President Kamala Harris introduced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate on Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
In his state, he has been a model chief executive, and with his experience, I'm telling you, Tim Walz will be ready on day one.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump also hails the political record of his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. But the former president recently downplayed the importance of vice presidential picks.
And I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president in terms of the election does not have any impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, virtually no impact. And it's all about the presidential pick.
Scholars explain that because vice presidents operate in the shadow of the U.S. president, their role is often misunderstood and unappreciated. They are, however, the first in line of succession when a president can no longer serve and key to advancing their party's political agenda. Vice presidential scholar Joe Goldstein via Skype.
Their role is really to act as a subordinate to help promote and pursue the president's policies and to expand the president's ability to function as a national and international leader.
To a certain extent, VP picks can boost presidential campaigns, Goldstein says.
Bill Clinton's pick of Al Gore in 1992 was a very good pick. The combination of these two young Southern centrist baby boomers really sent a message of generational change.
A bad pick is how the analyst described Republican Senator John McCain's decision to have Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate in 2008.
And she really became a figure who was parodied during the campaign and I think ended up hurting the McCain ticket, It wasn't the reason that Senator McCain lost.
This election cycle, Tim Walz's credentials and his focus on pro-family economics is what the Harris campaign is betting on. Elizabeth Clemens is a political sociologist at the University of Chicago. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
A version of being pro-family that is not about the control of reproduction, but is about the economic support of families, be that education, health care, housing, job development.
J.D. Vance will help advance the Republican narrative, says analyst Peter Loach. Loach is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. He spoke via Zoom.
The narrative they're telling that is, you know, there used to be an America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, middle class, hardworking family, you could succeed, and that America is now gone, and that if you vote for them, that America will come back.
Even if vice presidential candidates rarely make a major difference in elections, analysts say U.S. voters will pay attention to how well the current VP picks listen to the electorate and channel their concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Major General Kenneth Ekman, a senior military officer for the U.S. Africa Command, has told the French news agency, AFP, that the United States still has shared security objectives with Niger, whose ruling junta demanded that U.S. forces leave the jihadist-hit West African nation. The U.S. military on Monday withdrew from a final base in Niger, a drone facility at Agadez, and handed it over to the authorities in the Sahelian country where military leaders seized power a year ago. And that's it for this Thursday, August 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton Washington saying, have a great day. And please be safe, whatever you do.
Since 2014, the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, has brought 500 young people from across Africa to the United States. On the next edition of Our Voices, we will introduce you to some extraordinary young African women from over the past decades to share their experiences in the Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders program. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 19:00.